The mayor of Istanbul is also the leading opposition figure in Turkey.
He knows how to relate to ordinary people at a time when Turkey's ruling elite seem more and more isolated.
And that's why today people in Istanbul are angry after the mayor was arrested. I'm Marco Werman. More on that story from Turkey. Plus, it's starting to look like a new chapter in U.S.-Russian relations.
Trump now is more interested in generally having a greater rapprochement on many different issues with Russia.
We'll also meet someone who moved to the United States as a teenager with eyes firmly set on one day playing in the NCAA basketball tournament.
Yeah, ever since I got to New York, I've known that it's my goal to play in the tournament and to win with the team.
This week, she gets her chance. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. In Turkey, a prominent political rival of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is now behind bars. He's also the mayor of Istanbul and was arrested by Turkish police in an early dawn raid. Prosecutors are accusing him of corruption and terrorism, but the mayor's supporters believe the charges against him are politically motivated.
Just before his arrest, Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu posted a video.
Üzülerek söylüyorum.
In it, he stands in a walk-in closet, slowly tying a blue patterned tie around his neck, as if getting dressed for the office. He's keeping his voice down.
Milletimizin iradesini gasp etmeye çalışan.
I say this with regret. A handful of minds are trying to usurp the will of the nation, he says. Hundreds of officers have massed at my door, he continues. And in doing so, they have massed at the door of 16 million Istanbulites. I love you all very much. I entrust myself to my people, he says. It was a way to speak directly to his supporters, despite the government's efforts to silence him. Not long after İmamoğlu posted this video on his social media pages, the Turkish government blocked Instagram and Twitter, too. Prosecutors issued arrest warrants for İmamoğlu and more than 100 other people, including his close aides and leaders of smaller districts within Istanbul. They're accused of a wide-ranging conspiracy involving corruption, bribery, and links to Kurdish militants. This is a coup, said İmamoğlu's opposition party colleague, Özgür Özel. We do not recognize these accusations. This is a blow against the will of the people of Istanbul. As the government shut down metro lines and placed a four-day ban on demonstrations, Turkish voters took to the streets. Near the campus of Istanbul University, prosecutors pushed through a line of riot police to cheers and whistles.
I think people had come to accept the kind of competitive authoritarianism, liberal landscape, but this is one more level.
Aslı Aydın Taşbaş is a Washington-based analyst at the Brookings Institution. She says Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is feeling threatened by İmamoğlu's popularity.
He knows how to relate to ordinary people at a time when Turkey's ruling elite seem more and more isolated and living in ivory towers.
When Istanbul voters first elected İmamoğlu to lead the city in 2019, the moment was electric. Finally, after more than a decade of Turkish President Erdogan's party controlling most branches of government, a candidate had emerged who seemed to have the guts to face him. İmamoğlu was that guy.
He's run on the idea of hope. There will be better days. It is going to be sunshine. Trust me, we are going to be in a better place. And I think that was a very powerful message at a time when people felt let down and hopeless.
On Sunday, İmamoğlu's party, the CHP, is set to nominate its candidate for presidential elections, widely expected to be İmamoğlu. The elections are scheduled for 2028, but many believe Erdogan will call for them sooner. Washington Institute analyst Sonar Çaptay says recent polling shows that İmamoğlu could win.
I think the conclusion was that once he's anointed as the opposition CHP's presidential candidate, it'd be impossible to act against him, so do it before.
Çaptay says this arrest shows that Erdogan is afraid of İmamoğlu. After all, the two men have had strikingly similar paths to power, including brief stints in jail.
President Erdogan was sent to jail when he was the mayor of Istanbul at the same time as well on sham charges for violating Turkey's constitution, completely phony allegations. He served a really brief time in jail, but he entered jail as the mayor of a city and he exited it as a national hero.
And so Çağatay wonders, with this arrest, is Erdogan creating his own worst enemy?
Plaza de Toros, Mexico, and Mexico City is the biggest bullfighting ring in the world, holding almost 42,000 fans and often filled to capacity. But the bullfights themselves will be changing. Lawmakers in Mexico's capital have voted to make them bloodless. Diego Ore is a reporter with Reuters based in Mexico.
The new measure will not allow bullfighters to use spades and swords to attack the animal. The bull will have its horns covered to prevent injuries to bullfighters, also prohibited to cut their ears and tail, and any other type of abuse against the animal during or before the bullfight.
I know that President Claudia Sheinbaum supported the move. How much did animal rights activists play a role in moving this law forward?
Yesterday, one of the world's largest animal welfare organizations, Human World for Animals, welcomed the ban, but warned that free from violence does not mean free from suffering. Mm. They say that bulls will continue to be subject to the stress of being transported and entering a noisy bull ring, so they are going to reduce the time that the bull is in the bullfight from almost 2 hours to now 15 minutes.
Where do these bulls come from in Mexico City? Are there breeding programs in Mexico that just crank out the biggest, toughest bulls? And do you think that's going to change now that blood has been taken out of the equation?
Most of these bulls initially came from Spain, but now they are bred here in northern states. But yeah, for sure, this is going to change because they're going to need lesser bulls for the bullfights.
I imagine, too, that there are people who are very attached to bullfighting as a matter of tradition and ritual. What are they saying about the new rules?
Basically, they're saying that these rules are going to attract less people to the bullfight. As you said, Mexico City is home to the world's largest bull ring, even larger than those in Spain, which birthed this tradition.
I understand that there are a lot of people, vendors, selling things around the bullfighting ring in Mexico City. They depend on these big crowds. What could they be facing if, like, fans just stop showing up?
Yesterday, they protest. They tried to enter Mexico City Congress.
The vendors?
Yes, they were stopped by the police, the vendors and people who support bullfights. They said that they are going to lose their jobs.
What were the demands of those vendors?
Well, mainly they don't want this legislation. They want the bullfights to stay how they are. As this was an agreement between the opposition and the government, it's going to take time to write some part of the law, and maybe it's going to take place in late this year or early next year.
Diego Ore is a reporter with Reuters based in Mexico. Basketball fans are rejoicing. March Madness is here. Last year's tournament helped turn Caitlin Clark into a household name, and this year's rosters are loaded with talent looking to make their mark in the NCAA tournament. The world's Bianca Hillier profiles one athlete at the University of Notre Dame who moved to the U.S. for the love of the game.
Christina Rady knows a good basketball player when she sees one. So when she saw a video of a young Kay Koval...
Koval going to work with the left hand.
I was like, oh, we need to Zoom tonight.
They needed to meet on Zoom because Koval wasn't anywhere near New York's Long Island Lutheran High School, where Rady is the head coach. Koval was in Kyiv, Ukraine, her hometown. She'd been competing with Ukraine's youth national team for a few years, but she was reaching a limit there. Coach Rady helped her find a host family so she could come play in New York.
She came over here, ending her freshman, heading into her sophomore year.
That was August of 2021. Rady says Koval adjusted to the U.S. super fast, even navigating New York public transit alone. But just 6 months after she arrived, Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, where Koval's family still lived.
She was up all night, obviously checking Twitter, and then couldn't get in touch with her parents the next day, which was a very emotional day.
The team had a game that day, and Rady says she took a walk with Koval to try and take off some pressure.
I was like, listen, we don't have to play this game today. And she was like, I mean, are you kidding? She's like, we're playing the game. I was like, well, you don't have to play personally. And she's like, that's insulting. I was like, okay. And she went on to have like quite the stat line. She had like a triple-double. It was unbelievable.
Moments like that helped strengthen an already tight bond between Koval and Rady, who says she sees Koval more like an adopted child.
I'm never getting rid of Kate. Like, she'll probably still come over for Thanksgiving and Christmases.
Koval says the feeling is mutual.
She means everything to me. I talk to her every day. She's been there through the hardest times with everything going back home. And yeah, they are like my second family, my New York family.
That support helped Koval excel in basketball over the next few years. And when it was time to choose a college, she was a top 10 recruit. This season, Koval started her NCAA career at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana.
With a couple of threes to start the third quarter. Koval inside, count it, and a foul for the best low post player in the class.
It's been a lot of learning, a lot of adjusting to whatever role the team needed me to do. So yeah, I would say one word I would describe is like I was a sponge, just soaking it all in.
Specifically, the 6'5" forward says the pace of the game is a lot faster than it was in high school. And just like any college freshman, she's had to work on time management. But teammate Maddie Westbeld told the media that Koval doesn't play like any other freshman. She's better.
You know, you can definitely see that European play a little bit, the European style, where she can do a lot. And she's very mature, and just her IQ is unbelievable.
In this year's March Madness tournament, Notre Dame is looking to advance to the Elite Eight for the first time since 2019. Koval could be a key player in helping them get there. It's a tournament she's been working toward for years.
Ever since I got to New York, I've known that it's my goal to play in the tournament. For me, I just love to win and I love to play basketball. So I'm just excited to have more games.
Koval declined to talk extensively about what's going on in Ukraine. It's an emotional subject, and while many family members have now left the country, her father still lives there and serves in the military. She clearly finds comfort in basketball and also enjoys playing with fashion for pre-game photo ops. Think a stripy white blouse with black detailing or pairing chunky sneakers with ruffled orange socks.
I feel like it brings me confidence and just having something else outside of basketball that brings me joy and almost like makes me relax for a little bit.
As long as it doesn't get in the way of getting locked in for the game, she adds. Koval and Notre Dame's Fighting Irish start their March Madness journey on Friday when they play Stephen F. Austin at 2:00 Eastern time. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
There is more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now than there has been during the past 800,000 years. Yep, you heard that right, 800,000 years. That's one of several dire findings in a new climate report from the World Meteorological Organization. Those rising carbon dioxide levels caused by burning fossil fuels are trapping heat and driving climate change. The WMO report says ocean heat and average sea levels are at record highs. It also states that these changes are locked in for hundreds of years. The effects of climate change are not isolated only to the environment. The WMO concludes that extreme weather events displace more people in 2024 than in any year since 2008, and that climate change is making extreme weather events both more frequent and more severe. Coming right up, we go to Tokyo, where people are reflecting on the worst modern-day terrorist attack in Japan's history. It was carried out by a fringe religious group that still operates today. You're listening to The World.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. I've spent the past 4 years investigating a crime.
When you're driving down this road, all right, plan on killing somebody.
A four-year investigation. Hundreds of interviews, thousands of documents, all in an effort to see what the U.S. military has kept from the public for years.
Did you think that a war crime had been committed?
I don't have any opinion on that.
Season 3 of In the Dark is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. 30 years ago this week, members of a doomsday cult released packages of sarin gas on subway cars in downtown Tokyo. 13 people died. Nearly 6,000 were injured, some of them severely. Japanese police arrested dozens of cult members, including the group's leader, Shoko Asahara. He was put to death in 2018, along with 12 others. The World's Matthew Bell has this look back, reporting from the site of the attack in Tokyo.
It was a Tuesday morning, just after 8 a.m., peak of the rush hour on the Tokyo subway, when station agents here at the Kasumigaseki station got a call from their central office. They were told, "Suspicious item on board, please verify." One of the first to go downstairs to the platform was Assistant Station Master Kazumasa Takahashi. When he got there, the 50-year-old Takahashi found a bag with liquid leaking onto the floor of a subway car. He and a colleague grabbed some newspapers out of a trash can and wiped up the liquid so the train could get moving again and people could get to work. Takahashi collapsed a few minutes later. In police radio calls from that morning, you can hear the confusion. An officer from headquarters says, "This might be some kind of incident or a train crash, but the details are not clear." What did become clear quickly, though, was that this was a mass casualty event. Here's a cop speaking from outside of a Tokyo subway station. Commuters there were emerging from the underground, some of them falling down on the sidewalk and struggling to breathe. "They've inhaled something," the officer says. "Maybe gasoline or paint thinner." Then he tells police headquarters to send reinforcements immediately. This is the exit of the subway station where Kazumasa Takahashi was carried out on a stretcher by his colleagues. When no ambulance showed up here, there was a TV crew that had a van and they drove him to the hospital. But it took time for the medical staff there and at other Tokyo hospitals to realize what was going on and even to begin to know how to treat the massive numbers of people who were suffering from sarin gas poisoning. Shitsue Takahashi says that on the day of the sarin gas attack, she and station master Kazumasa had been married for 24 years. He was a gentle person, she tells me, and a good father to their three children. Later that day, Takahashi says her boss at the bank where she worked drove her to the hospital. "I saw my husband lying on the bed, still wearing his uniform," she tells me, "and he was already cold." Takahashi says she had never heard of a religious group called Om Shinrikyo before. She did hear about sarin gas in the news because there was an attack the year before in the Japanese city of Matsumoto that killed 7 people. Members of Om Shinrikyo were later found to be behind that attack as well.
Over the years now, are you an expert about this group?
"This is the group responsible for the death of my husband," she says. "I wanted to know what they did and why, so I started going to court. In fact, Takahashi was so relentless, she helped change the laws in Japan to give victims' families the right to attend trial proceedings in person. She has become an outspoken advocate for the victims of the 1995 sarin gas attack, helping them win compensation from the government and demanding more transparency. Takahashi says she wants people to remember what happened 30 years ago. On a recent afternoon, interpreter Aya Asakura and I stopped people on the street in central Tokyo to ask if they know about the 1995 subway attack. Mizuki Takakawa and Miu Usuda are both in their early 20s.
Om Shinrikyo. Asahara Shoko.
I know that Om cult and also Shoko Asahara did it. That's what I know. I don't know much about it because I don't get to learn about it, but that's as much as I know.
All of the older folks we speak with say they remember the sarin gas attack. Ipei Koike, who's 72, says there are all kinds of religious groups, and some of them are dangerous.
So,
Nowadays, we feel that all the information available to us at our disposal, but it's actually not true. So I feel the importance of really disclosing the information that's critical to us so we know that what kind of activities are going on.
Koike goes on to say that harmful cults are not just a problem in Japan. They're everywhere, including the United States. At one time, Om Shinrikyo had thousands of members in many different countries. It was founded in the late 1980s by Shoko Asahara, who preached a mix of beliefs from Buddhism, Hinduism, and Christianity. The group was declared a terrorist organization in Japan, but it still exists today, just under different names. Shoko Egawa is a journalist and university professor who's written a lot about Om Shinrikyo. She says these people still pose a threat. I wouldn't expect them to use sarin gas or try to manufacture weapons, she says. So in terms of that kind of danger, I think it's very unlikely. But Egawa says people in spin-off groups still worship the late Shoko Asahara, and we need to be on alert, she says. The biggest Om Shinrikyo spin-off has about 1,000 members. Japanese security services monitor them closely, including their financial activities, places of worship, and where they live. One of the group's buildings in Tokyo actually has a small police trailer right next to it. But Shoko Egawa worries that there hasn't been enough public messaging or education about the dangers posed by religious cults in Japan. That's why she's currently teaching a university course on the subject. My students were born later, she says, so they don't have their own memories of what happened. Egawa says when they learn that a lot of ordinary young people joined Om Shinrikyo, her students are genuinely shocked. Late last month, Japan's Public Security Intelligence Agency set up a new website about the 1995 Tokyo subway attack. It's got videos and archive photos about the beliefs and criminal activities of Om Shinrikyo, which the website describes as an ongoing problem. And there's testimony from victims' relatives, including Shitsue Takahashi. Her husband, the station master who was killed 30 years ago, is also honored in the subway station where he worked.
On the wall of this tunnel, there's a small black plaque honoring Kazumasa Takahashi and his colleague Tsuneo Hishinuma. It says, through their precise and courageous judgment, they protected the lives of many passengers and sacrificed their own. For the World, I'm Matthew Bell in Tokyo.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. We are very much on track. That's how President Trump described the upshot of his phone conversation today with Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky. The call came a day after Trump spoke with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. White House officials say during that conversation, Putin agreed to temporarily halt strikes on energy infrastructure if Kyiv did the same. But shortly after they hung up, Russian forces struck the energy grid in the city of Slovyansk in eastern Ukraine. So how does the Kremlin see the talks and potential negotiations over a ceasefire in Ukraine? We asked Nina Khrushcheva for her observations. She's a professor of international affairs teaching this semester at the New School in New York.
I think the Kremlin is content. The phone call seemed to have gone very well. Putin didn't lose anything. I mean, Putin stayed in the lane that he was in, while Trump didn't get what he wanted. It was interesting that the Russian side had the information about the call, put it out very quickly, which is normally not the case because they take a bit of time. And it was also quite detailed, unlike the American side. And also there are things that both sides were saying, that now the groups are formed to continue with broader ceasefire agreement and then eventual peace agreement. We already know that. I think they even have dates in a few days. They're meeting, the Russian side and the American side are meeting in El Riad. So far, Putin is playing his hand very cool and getting what he thinks he should get, but also keeping Trump content as well, because Trump is continuing to act and appear as if he eventually going to be successful in something that he claimed that he's going to be the great peacemaker.
Just looking at some of the media outlets in Moscow that the Kremlin allows to operate, they all seem to see this as a win for Putin. I'm wondering if they really see it as a win or if they have to say it is a win.
I mean, I don't think it's a win or loss because I don't think we're there. It's in some ways because there's been so much animosity and hatred on all sides. It has to be win-win, lose-lose. For example, we know that one of the original conditions, and the Russians said that this was a condition, but then Trump said there was not a condition, that Ukraine is not going to receive any military aid in this 30 days. So that already was not a win just because Putin wanted it and didn't get it, or at least we were not hearing about this, that they got it, and Trump says it was not even part of a conversation. But Putin continues on, and so far he, unlike others, have not lost anything, because Vladimir Zelensky, for example, after the Ukrainians and the Americans met in El Riad last week, had to agree to the full ceasefire. Trump did not get the full ceasefire from Putin, but Putin so far has not lost anything.
Interestingly, you kind of raise it there. The most basic details of the phone call and the readout are in dispute. Moscow says the issue of military supplies being sent to Kyiv was touched upon. Trump says we didn't talk about aid at all. The fact that the two leaders spent 90 minutes talking to each other must make the Ukrainians nervous, yeah?
Yes, of course Ukrainians are nervous. And of course, yesterday, Europeans are nervous too. And we saw the minute after, very quickly after the phone call, Emmanuel Macron announced some bellicose idea of how Europe is going to be prepared for the future of Russian-American rapprochement. I think what was interesting about the phone call, so it seemed to me, is that, I mean, it was about Ukraine, but it was also a side conversation in some ways, or under the umbrella of a larger U.S.-Russian relations. It was under the umbrella that they're not going to have Iran defeat Israel or threaten Israel, so which was also kind of an interesting thing, because I'm sure Trump asked Putin about this, and Putin must have, I don't know, but I imagine said, well, that's okay. I mean, we deal with Iran, but if you ask me, I will not be openly on Iran's side. So there are things like that of which Ukraine became one part of a conversation. So it seems to me that Trump now is more interested in generally having a greater rapprochement on many different issues with Russia.
The conversation reportedly included discussions around improving bilateral relations and the potential for what the White House described as enormous economic deals. Where do you think all this is headed?
Well, that's another thing. I mean, Trump is a businessman. That's more important for him than probably anything. And I think that's why they've been touting the economic cooperation, because he wants profits Russia can offer. When the first conversation happened of the rare earth metals, Putin's response was, well, we're a much larger territory. We have rare earth metals too. Mm. And so that probably is also part of the conversation.
And on the flip side, what are the chances that we could soon see the full rehabilitation of Vladimir Putin on the world stage?
Well, we're already sort of seeing that, because the isolation didn't happen. I mean, I know the West has been saying, well, Putin is isolated. He was isolated in the West. He wasn't isolated in the rest of the world. That actually allowed him to continue his argument that it's the remnants of colonialism, that the countries in Europe, or West countries affiliated with countries in Europe, only see themselves as the major force, but all the others are not recognized. So it's the West versus the rest. And so in this sense, Putin wasn't isolated. And now when Trump talks to Putin and offers more legitimacy, that certainly closer to rehabilitation. I'm not sure that Europe or Japan or South Korea would agree to that, but that rehabilitation would be no less divisive than it has been, but basically confirms more that isolating Putin as the original plan was really didn't work out as a plan.
Nina Khrushcheva is a professor of international affairs. She's teaching at the New School in New York. Americans might not be familiar with it because the U.S. Agency for Global Media has always been focused on audiences abroad. An estimated 400 million people tuned in to news programs from The Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and Radio Free Asia. For decades, they've been broadcasting in places where press freedoms are largely absent. But late last week, President Trump issued an executive order to shut it all down. As Levi Bridges reports, that is a big deal in places like Central Asia and in countries in Russia's orbit.
When Fryanok Vachorko was growing up in Soviet Belarus back in the 80s, most of the information he got about where he lived was propaganda. But then he discovered Radio Free Europe, and it kind of blew his mind.
You realize that for the whole life, you were living like in the prison.
It wasn't just news programs that impacted Vachorko.
The programs about Belarusian language, culture, and history. Basically, it substitutes the school for me because I learned more things through the Radio Free Europe than in the school.
Radio Free Europe is part of a network of U.S.-funded media outlets that were first broadcast into Germany during World War II to give Germans access to outside information under Nazi rule.
Hier spricht eine Stimme aus Amerika.
This is the very first broadcast from Voice of America.
This is a voice speaking from America.
A voice from America at war.
VOA later expanded to the Soviet Union. Decades later, these networks still provide vital information about the region. Recently, reporters with Radio Free Europe filmed in eastern Ukraine as shells exploded near the front line. Vyacheslav Lihachev is with the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Center for Civil Liberties in Ukraine. He says these U.S.-funded outlets are really important for Ukrainians who have fled places like the Crimean Peninsula that are now occupied by Russia.
It is the first website they open in the morning when they want to have some information about their homeland, about Crimea.
These networks are independent. The U.S. government just provides them with financial support. Rohit Mahajan is the chief communications officer for Radio Free Asia, one of the networks now targeted with funding cuts. He says these news outlets focus on countries with limited press freedom.
So that means going into some of the toughest media landscapes like China, North Korea, other places where free press and free speech is not a guaranteed right.
Their reporters often have unique expertise. Unlike many foreign correspondents, myself included, reporters working with Mahajan's network are from the regions they cover.
So many journalists who work for us, they haven't graduated from Columbia Journalism School or come with these bona fides, but what they do have is this on-the-ground knowledge.
That's more than a news industry detail. People count on the services these reporters provide. It wasn't until I lived in the former Soviet republics of Central Asia that I understood how widely consumed these news sources are here. I once sat next to a woman on public transit in rural Tajikistan who was reading articles from Radio Free Europe on an old smartphone. It surprised me then, but it wouldn't surprise me now. And I can't tell you how many times I've been trying to get information on a topic, and literally the only source I found has been a Radio Free Europe story. There are plenty of haters, though. Authoritarian governments in Central Asia have recently been restricting press freedoms, and journalists working for U.S.-funded outlets in countries like Turkmenistan have been detained, tortured, even killed. Central Asian governments have also tried to shut these networks down. That's why people from Central Asia who I talked to for the story asked not to use their names or mention what country they live in. A Central Asian journalist I spoke to over the phone tells me local publications without U.S. support just don't have the money to employ journalists in rural regions or do real investigative reporting. I talked to a woman in Central Asia who fears the disappearance of U.S.-funded media will just create more space for misinformation on all kinds of topics.
I have this lady who comes and helps me at home, and she says, have you heard that this measles vaccine gives autism to children? I was like, where do you get this information? She says, it's this lady on TikTok. She was crying. She said, this vaccine disabled my child or something.
She also says the U.S. government closing independent media organizations sends a scary message to authoritarian leaders.
It kind of gives a signal to all the other dictators across the globe to do whatever they feel like doing. They say, okay, even if America can do that, we can do that too. Like, what's stopping us?
Leaders in the European Union are now rallying for funds to keep organizations like Radio Free Europe alive. If they're successful, the information will continue to flow, If not, millions of people in authoritarian countries will have a much harder time accessing the truth. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges.
There are moments in sports that are transcendent, when a longstanding record is broken, when a superstar's number is retired, or when a team memorializes a former player who's recently died. Over the weekend, the professional Bulgarian soccer club, UFC Arda, announced the death of its former striker, Petko Gonchev, and held a moment of silence before their match to mourn his passing. Players from both sides huddled together at the center circle of the pitch. While this was happening, 78-year-old Gonchev was actually driving home, blissfully unaware of the news of his own demise. When he got there, his wife was apoplectic. Friends had been calling nonstop. Gonchev says he spent the rest of that Sunday at home watching soccer and fielding calls until midnight, but not before pouring himself a glass of brandy and making a toast to his own good health. The management of his old team called Gonchev and put out a statement apologizing for their premature announcement and wishing him the best. In Mexico, people are shocked by a gruesome discovery, a facility in western Mexico used by drug cartel members to execute people. News reports are calling it an extermination camp, and it's reignited national outrage over the countless disappeared people across Mexico and the failure to bring those responsible to justice. From Mexico City, The World's TBC Isaiah has our story, and a warning, listeners, this report contains disturbing details of violence.
In the summer of last year, dozens of young people started to disappear at a bus station in Guadalajara in the western state of Jalisco.
Mi hijo desapareció el 6 de agosto. Salió de mi casa y le ofrecieron un trabajo de chofer.
Several mothers of the missing said their kids were responding to online ads for jobs, including as drivers, security guards, construction workers, farmers, and they had been told to meet a recruiter at the bus terminal. Then they disappeared. There was a strong suspicion that these young people, hundreds of them it turns out, were being recruited by the Jalisco New Generation Cartel. That's one of the most powerful criminal organizations in Mexico.
La pregunta era, ¿a dónde se los llevaba?
The question was, where were they taken, says Indira Navarro, a volunteer with the group Searching Warriors of Jalisco. She's been searching for her disappeared brother for years and started looking into these cases.
La persona que nos dio este aviso, que nos dijo, saben que vayan, van a encontrar muchas evidencias.
She got a number of anonymous tips on Facebook saying that there was a mass grave hidden in a ranch outside the city of Guadalajara.
Fiscalía entra a este predio y pues hace el cateo, pero nada más asegura pues las personas.
She says the police raided the site in September, made 10 arrests and released 2 hostages. But somehow they failed to properly inspect and secure the location. One of Navarro's anonymous informants told her to keep looking. So a few weeks ago, she and 40 other volunteers show up at the site, armed with picks, shovels, and sensors, hoping to find some sign of their missing loved ones. What they found was horrific. Hundreds and hundreds of bone shards, skulls, fingers, teeth, she says, piles of shoes and discarded personal items, 3 underground cremation ovens, and figurines of Santa Muerte, a god worshipped by many criminals in Mexico. It was an extermination camp, Navarro says. Mass graves turn up nearly every week in Mexico, but the evidence found here points to a site being used to train people in the use of killing and torture techniques. Since the discovery, several people have offered anonymous testimony to both Navarro and Mexican media of what happened there. This man told a local reporter that he was forced to dismember and burn his victims as part of his training. If he and other recruits objected, they were sometimes fed to wild animals, he says. For many Mexicans, the worst part of this gruesome discovery is that local police either didn't find or didn't reveal any evidence of what was going on at the site. David Mora is with the International Crisis Group in Mexico City.
It points to corruption allegations. Why did the local prosecutors ignore the whole thing? Did they ignore it? Or is that their investigations are so poorly driven that they failed to realize the magnitude of what was going on in the place that they had just raided?
President Claudia Sheinbaum ordered an investigation and announced reforms aimed at addressing the mass disappearance crisis in the country. On average, one person goes missing every hour in Mexico, and according to official data, close to 120,000 people remain disappeared. For the world, I'm Tibisay Isaya, Mexico City.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's no secret how China built the second biggest economy on Earth, exports. In other words, selling products abroad. That's what propelled China's rise to international superpower status. But tariffs and trade wars are presenting a challenge for Beijing. Chinese officials announced new measures this week to boost domestic spending. They're hoping that will help keep the country on track to meet its growth projection of 5%. Zoe Liu is a senior fellow for China Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations.
The idea is to increase domestic spending, domestic consumption as a way to mitigate potential rising trade protectionism from the rest of the world and to absorb China's industrial capacity at home. So far, I would say the specific areas are fairly clear. Broadly speaking, it includes smart appliances, digital products like cell phone or EVs. Basically, these are things that China has built a lot of industrial capacities over the past few years and in a lot of ways are also global leader.
Yeah, especially in EVs. The U.S. economy is really built on consumers, as we know. Is that fundamentally any different in China?
So to put this in a context, China's household consumption as a percentage of GDP is about 34 to 38%, whereas the rest of the world, not just the United States, but the rest of the world, on average, household consumption as a percentage of GDP is about 60%. So from that perspective, the Chinese economy indeed is underconsumed, especially at household level. And on top of that, China's manufacturing capacity has actually been leading the world for the past decade. And this is sort of the bigger background of China's export growth in the sense that if China contributes to about 30% of global manufacturing output, that basically is bigger than the combination of US plus Germany plus France plus Italy plus Japan. So it all makes sense why China is the world the factory of the world. And in contrast, domestic consumption indeed at household level is not necessarily as a significant contributor to the GDP growth.
Got it. I suppose it's no surprise why China is taking these moves. The Trump administration has introduced new tariffs for Chinese imports. Explain for us, though, the connection between that and this push in China to increase domestic spending.
Even if there were no Trump tariffs, the Chinese government need to rebalance its economy in a way such that it's less dependent on investment and more dependent on household consumption. But the 2018 tariff, and now fast forward to this new round of tariff, basically forced the Chinese government to accelerate the timeline. And this time is also slightly different than 2018 tariff trade war in the sense that in 2018, the Chinese government expanded export to developing countries. But this time, developing countries are also very much concerned about the inflow of cheap Chinese goods to crush their own industrial sector. So if we describe this world as rising trade protectionism or concerns about cheap Chinese manufactured product flooding into the rest of the world, then of course it makes a lot of sense for the Chinese government to use policy measures to stimulate the economy specifically by boosting household consumption.
Interesting. I've heard many anecdotes about how Chinese citizens are seeing the economic fragility and personally seem ready to economize, to cut back. You mentioned the chronic problem of underconsumption there. How do you think Chinese will respond to the government's plan for them to spend more?
This is where I think the challenge for the effectiveness of the policy would be, how to boost consumer confidence. So here, I think it's very tricky, and it really comes down to how the government use the combination of fiscal and monetary policy to stabilizing the housing market and to boost income growth and to provide retirement and healthcare support without making people feel at individual level their economic security it has improved. Perhaps having Chinese people to spend, increase consumption is not as easy. On top of that, the memory of COVID restrictions and that psychological shock at a consumer level is not easy to get rid of. So in other words, this is not going to be an easy job or easy target to achieve to boost household consumption.
Zoe Liu is a senior fellow for China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. At a track meet in New Zealand today, a high school student broke the record as the youngest person to run a mile in under 4 minutes. Sam Ruth finished a race in just over 3 minutes and 58 seconds. He's not yet 16, 15 years and 341 days old to be exact. That's about 9 months younger than the previous record holder. Sam Ruth documented the morning leading up to the race in a video posted online.
What is going on, guys? Today is the day. Today is the day that we try and break four. Youngest person to ever break four is my goal.
After a shakeout, which is a light jog to prepare for the big race, it was time for breakfast, which Sam was sharing with a fellow runner named George.
All right, guys, we just finished our shakeout run. Just feeling good. Just cracking some breakfast right now. It was like George is struggling a little bit.
Cut to two eggs sunny side up, hopelessly stuck to what appears to be a non-stick pan.
I'm really good at frying eggs. It may look like this is an absolute mess, but like, this is how they're supposed to be done. This is getting even worse.
Not a good start for the day.
But fortunately for Sam, it doesn't take a Michelin star to prepare a breakfast of champions. After a meal and a long drive to Auckland, he took his spot on the starting line.
On your mark.
All right, and we're away in the Financial Independence Elite Men's Mile.
Sam Ruth and his pacemaker Sam Tanner quickly pulled to the front of the pack, and that is where they stayed. Then, as the final lap came to a close...
Sam Tanner smiling! Sam Ruth's right there! Woohoo! All right! That's a sub-4, baby! That's a sub-4.
A full second and a half short of 4 minutes, Sam pulled it off, setting that new world record. Congrats, Sam. That is not too shabby at all. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Glasscock Heritage Trust, Jennifer Woodruff, Cindy Engels, Merle Kurtzrock and George Zimmerman, and Carrie and Nelson Hoffman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.